Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Chatting with Sherry. This week we have the lovely Christine Hannon, who has joined us to talk about her book, A Hairdresser's Diary. Welcome, Christine.
Thank you, Sherry. I'm extremely excited to be talking to you today.
Well, I'm really happy to have you here. Tell us a bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I am a 68-year-old woman from Paris, Ontario, Canada. I've been hairdressing, and the book is mostly about my hairdressing years, but I've been hairdressing since I've been about 14 years old. I have three children, grown children, two grandchildren, and a hubby, which we just celebrated 49 years married, so I'm an old hat at that as well.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you.
How did you start writing? What brought that about?
Well, I've always written poetry. I've written poetry since I can remember. But writing a story, I never, ever thought that would come about. But my son-in-law decided that the stories that I would be telling him and everybody else should be in print form. So he convinced me that I should take the stories and write them down and make them available to other people. And with some coaxing, that's exactly what I did.
That's great. And did you do your own editing, or did someone else do your editing? How did, since you're a first-time writer, how did you get that taken care of?
Well, I belong to a group called LinkedIn, and I don't know very much about editing or the book process. We had about six people helping me edit, and it's amazing how other people see work the way it should be or the way it shouldn't be. They were extremely helpful. They helped me put the right punctuation in the right places, and sometimes the wrong words. Being a Canadian, we had a problem with the Canadian words, the Canadian spelling. I finally was able to convince a couple of the people that helped me that, being a Canadian, I would really like to have the words spelled in you know, Canadian form, and that went over well once they realized it wasn't a misspelling.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's an interesting point. I mean, if you read a book written by an English woman, it would be completely different from an American. But people, because Canada is our neighbor, they don't realize that Canadians have a lot of the same spelling as English people do.
Right, right. That was a little bit of a problem. They were marking it down as misspelled words until they realized, oh, no, it's okay, you know. And being from Canada, I wanted it written that way. So we did leave it.
When you, how do you ignite your imagination? Do you like to read, or do you watch a movie, or is it just conversations you hear?
If it has to do with the book, it's a memoir. So I have no problems coming up with my memories. As a matter of fact, Sherry, I find it very, very weird that when I start writing, it just floods. It just floods back to me. Memories that I thought were long buried just come out of the end of my pen or out my fingertips.
I found that myself. I'm actually working on a memoir, too, and I've never written a memoir. I've always written fiction, and it's weird. I can remember stuff from when I was a kid.
Yeah, it is weird, isn't it? And mm-hmm. one memory ignites another. And before you know it, it's just flowing.
It is interesting.
The one thing I find, and I don't know if other hairdressers or waitresses or waiters or barbers or whatever remember things that maybe other people won't, because when we're doing hair, we have to remember what our customers use, what our customers want. So it's almost embedded in us. So that when
people are giving, I mean, I've gone to the hairdresser many times. When you're chatting away with the hairdresser, is it because you're remembering everything else that you need to remember for their hair, do you remember the conversations?
Yes. It's almost like we've trained ourselves to remember different facts, and then when you put one name and one fact together, then a lot of other things come back to you. I can, yes, definitely can remember definite conversations years and years ago.
That's interesting.
And, yeah.
So when you are when you were working on your book and you were remembering all the conversations and stuff, how did you decide what you would put into the book and what you wouldn't?
What I tried to stay clear from was anything that was damaging or hurtful to anybody.
Right.
There's so many really good, funny stories, stories about caring people, that it wasn't necessary to put in anything that wasn't like that. I didn't want anybody to read about the nasty customer that did nasty things, or the nasty person I worked with that was mean-spirited or not nice. I left all of that out. The only part of my book where you'll find any pain or any of those things is in the beginning of my book when I talk about my childhood. My book starts when I was six. And the only reason I even talked about my childhood in the beginning is so that people could see when they're reading my book that I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth, that the things that I strive for and the things I worked for and the dreams I had were very difficult to come by. And when they did, I wanted to pay back. I wanted to pay back to those people who gave to me, who helped me, and who were there for me.
Yeah. I understand that. Is that your biggest satisfaction when you completed your book, or was there other satisfaction?
No, the one thing that made me feel extremely proud of the book was I had a 12-year-old young girl email me, and she said to me, she read part of my book on Amazon. You can read a few pages, okay? She said, Chris, I wanted to work with animals. And she said, my parents have always told me I'm not worth anything, that I wouldn't be able to, that I am not, I'm sorry.
I was reacting, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that I'm not capable. She said, I read this part of your book. And she said, you gave me so much courage that she said, guess what? I am going to work with animals. She
Good
said, thank you.
Good
so,
for her.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Something like that.
That's amazing. That's something
it makes
you should
feel,
be proud of.
Yeah. So if I can touch somebody like that, then everything I've put in the book is worth it. My sister-in-law called me the other day and told me that her hairdresser, who is older like me, was going through the book, and she said, oh, I remember that. Oh, my goodness, does somebody else remember what it was like in those days? She said, I can remember doing all those things. So it makes me feel good that I can bring back memories to other people who find satisfaction in those memories.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember how different it was. My mom has had a little bit of a struggle with the fact that she's had a switch from having her hair set to having her hair cut, wash, and blow dry. I mean, to her, it's like the weirdest thing in the world. But she's actually done the transition, but it took me a long time to convince her to give it a shot.
It was a big transition for us as well. You have no idea how many burns we had on our fingers when we started using just curling irons instead of rollers, you know?
Yeah.
We did burn ourselves. One of the funny things, Sherry, is I worked in the beauty shop in Windsor, Ontario. It was the first salon ever to do men's hair during working hours.
Hmm. Yeah, that must have been strange when men started coming in.
It was. Some of the women were not too keen on having men sitting in the waiting rooms with them. And some of them were even their husbands. And they kind of felt uncomfortable at first. It didn't take long, though. Some of the men that were coming in to get their hair done, I really felt they were just coming in to see what
the
it
girls.
Was like to sit with a bunch of women. But you know what? It opened up so much for men to be pampered and be allowed the same. You didn't have to go to a barber shop and just get a haircut, and you know, you could get to go and have your hair styled, and you could have a perm or color as a male and not feel
weird,
uncomfortable.
Yeah, my dad, when he tried it. He didn't like it. He actually went back to barber, but he tried
right.
it a couple of times. The part he liked was him washing his hair, because barbers don't do that. He thought that
That's
was
right.
kind of cool.
Yeah.
But other than that, he really wasn't, he didn't like the fluffy, and he liked his, you know, old-fashioned cut. So it was like, nah, I'll take my wife, and I think I won't do it.
Yeah, I'm not going to share with this. We had men who came in and had manicures before they had their hair done in salons, but once it took off, it was very strange. You know, when men would say to us that, you know, I'm going to go to the salon, because they just couldn't before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I remember, I think it was in college in the 80s, was it, when men started getting perms?
Mm-hmm.
Was it the late 70s or the 80s? I don't remember if it was high school or college, but I just remember my dad never did, but one of my uncles did. And when I saw it, I thought, not the best look.
when they started getting perms and colors, some
yeah.
of them chose like way out. It was like way out, because they were going from not being able to. You know what? It's like a little kid in a candy shop. If you're on the outside of the window looking in and you only get to see what's in the candy shop, you can only think about. But once you're in the candy shop, you want to taste a little bit of everything.
Yeah,
well, men were the same way.
I think that must have been it, yeah. I remember after he did it and he came to a family dinner, and I was like, had to bite my cheeks.
Yeah, that and the fact that they could get their hair pieces done properly. We had a couple men who their wives would have bought them hair pieces. My goodness, they look like somebody took something out of the backyard and stuck it on their head. And they'd come in and they'd have it styled and cut properly, and so it looked like a real head of hair instead of, you know, just a piece of whatever. So they had that chance as well once they came into a salon, because barbers didn't do it. Barbers
no.
didn't cut and style the hair pieces that the men wore. So they had that opportunity
even,
as well.
Even gorgeous movie stars who had their hair done by professional hairdressers. I mean, like, I'm going to give you an example. Cary Grant, who I think was
right.
one of the most handsome men ever. I mean, they compare him to George Clooney, and I love George, but he doesn't compare to Cary Grant.
Right.
Well, I was watching North by Northwest, and you can see the tube. I mean, it was kind of
strange. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. You can see where the line is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't care. It, personally, I thought he was good when he took it off and he never acted again. And he had his hair the way it naturally was. I always thought he was handsome.
Yeah.
But I just thought, you know, with all these professionals,
yeah.
can't they do something?
Why can't they do better?
Yeah.
Right? Why can't they do better than what they've got there? Yeah. And one of the other things that I did in my career before. My career was ended quickly by a drunk driver. But before we did colors. Do you remember colors? When you had your colors done so that you knew what season you were, so you knew what kind of clothes to buy and what kind of makeup to wear?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we did that as hairdressers long before colors came into to effect for clothes and makeup, because as a hairdresser, you would learn how to do cool hair on a cool skin, warm hair on warm skin, or you'd have your customer looking like
terrible,
an alien, right, okay? And when men got into this, that's when they started wearing shirts and ties and suits that weren't just black and blue and brown.
That's true. I mean, I remember when, when I was a teenager, the 70s, when they wore those, stupid leisure suits in the blue. And
and no color.
Yeah, I mean, just those horrible leisure suits and Nehru jackets and, oh, my God. No, some people looked really good in those. Like Sammy Davis Jr. looked fantastic in a Nehru. But other people just looked like stupid.
Yeah, they did. But when men were able to start wearing pink shirts and turquoise and pale oranges, it was amazing what it did for them. Like we as women did so much for the men's scheme and color and style, and I don't think they realize it. I don't think they realize that by having them come into beauty salons, having them have their colors. I used to go into men's clothing stores and teach the men who are selling, the salespeople, how to do colors so that they could take their customers and say, look, you know what, don't be wearing that ugly brown that makes you look like you're death warmed over. Let it go into something that's got some color and some style to it.
Yeah.
And they felt better about themselves.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's interesting now that men wear pink ties and all this stuff, and I'm like, you know.
And they're not afraid to.
They're not. They're not worried about whether it'll affect their masculinity if they were.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't even have a thought now with the younger men. They don't even care. I mean, they know that they're masculine, and they don't care what people think. And with the Ryan Seacrest and the Metro Central Revolution.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's amazing how they've gone from one plane to something vibrant, something colorful, and it makes such a difference.
Yeah.
Those are all things that I've got in my book, which I'm proud of, because I was one of the first in Windsor to do any of those things. So I can look back and say, oh, my goodness, you know, I was there when it started. I was in the shop where it started. And when some of my customers or my clients are reading it, or my readers are reading it, it's amazing how they'll come back to me with a story of what happened, like you, with your family members.
Right.
It makes you think.
It does. It brings back memories.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about a taste of your book and what you'd like your readers to take away from the book.
My book has there are so many different things. I was a hairdresser, as you can tell by the hairdresser's hairdresser's diary. The picture on the front of the book is a picture of me when I was modeling. I was a model, makeup artist, and hairdresser. And about 7-8 years into my career, I was in a car accident and hit by a drunk driver, and my careers were taken away from me. So I had to reinvent myself. And so the reinvention, didn't get rid of hairdressing, but I can't tell you too much about how I reinvented myself, because that's in my sequel.
Okay, good.
The second book.
So that's your next book you're working on, is a continuation of what happened after you had your accident.
Absolutely. But this, I'm going to tell you one little story, if I can, that's in the book, and it's about Natalie. And it's just to give you a little taste, if that's okay,
okay.
of what you'll find in the book. I was working at Simpson Sears in Windsor, and I was very young, 17, mm-hmm. and this young girl came in to get her hair done. She had in her hand, she had a veil, but she had her back to me, a wedding veil, but she had her back to me, and my boss asked me if I would mind taking Natalie to take care of, you know, her needs for the day. And when she turned around, Natalie was covered with scars.
Oh.
She had been in a severe fire, and she had no eyebrows on one side of her face. She had a burn up into her hairline. Her lip was severely burned. She had a large burn down her neck. She had come in to have her hair done, and she figured there would be no makeup because she was so badly burned, but it was her wedding day. And when I had gone to hairdressing school, I took makeup artistry, stage makeup. And when I took a look at her, I put my arm around her, and I was very young, but I put my arm around her, and I asked her if she would come to the back with me and if she would trust me to do for her what I thought would be best for her wedding day. And I don't know why, but she trusted that I would take care of her. We took her to the back to a special quiet room because I didn't want people staring at her. And I called my teacher at my hairdressing school, and I asked her about the kit that we used for stage makeup. And she sent it over with one of the other students. And what we did that day was not only did we do Natalie's makeup, or her hair, but we did her makeup. And we used stage makeup, and we put on false eyelashes. I drew on eyelashes underneath her eyelids on the bottom. We drew on eyebrows. We drew on lip liner. We used the stage makeup that would not wash off. You had to use a cream to remove it. Then we did her hair, and we had a piece there was like a hair piece that we used as bangs because she had no hair in the front. It was just scars. And then we put her veil on. And all the time we were working on her, I didn't let her look in the mirror. When she was done, we turned her around to the mirror, and she saw herself. And she just said to me, "Oh, my, I am so beautiful." And she was starting to cry, and she said, "I can't cry, I can't cry." And I said, "Don't worry about it. It won't run. It's not going to come off until you want it to come off, till you remove it." And when her mom came in to pick her up, her mom started to cry. And when she left, she had her veil back over her head and not forward. And the next week I got a picture of her walking down the aisle. Her husband had sent it to me, and he said, "I want you to see Natalie as she walks down the aisle with a big smile."
Oh, that's a beautiful
story. She said she felt beautiful. She said Natalie saw herself the way I see her every day of my life.
Aww.
And that's just one of the things that I was able to do for someone, to give back to what good things people did for me.
That's very touching.
Well, there's all kinds of really good things like that in the book. And I just hope that somebody that's reading will find one of the stories that touched their hearts.
That's really beautiful. I have a question about writing. You were talking about your grandchildren and your children. And
yes.
With grandchildren and, you know, they're very active, children, and how do you find time to write?
Well, my granddaughter's 28 soon. This month, she's going to be 28 and getting married in July. My grandson's 8. My husband, there's just my husband and I here, so I just sit and write.
The 8-year-old doesn't bother you?
No, as a matter of fact, he comes to visit. When he's here visiting, he gets my books out. He is so sweet. I have some of my books here, and he takes them out, and I say, "What are you doing, honey?" He says, "Grammys, I'm getting your books ready for customers."
Aww. That's
so a friend
sweet.
Of mine came one day to drop something off, and he says, "Are you coming to buy my Grammy's book?" And she says, "I have your Grammy's book." He says, "Okay, then."
You're allowed.
Yeah. But he's, no, I have a lot of time to write. My husband works part-time. We're both retired, but he works part-time. And when he's gone, I just write.
So you don't have to offer either your husband or your grandson ice cream or something to give.
Nothing. He likes it when I write. He asks me to read him some stories and stuff. So, yeah, no. They're really, really accommodating.
Oh,
my granddaughter,
cool.
She said, "Grandma," she said, "I'm so proud of you." She said that you would do this. So it just, you know, it makes me feel so good that my kids feel this way, and my grandkids, and my husband. My husband is chairman of a St. Leonard's Society here in Brantford, and they help transition young people who are having problems with their families and homes, and they have houses for these young women and young men. They've just purchased 10 of my books for them to read, and they've asked me to go and talk to the young people about their dreams and how, no matter how bad your childhood is, no matter how bad things get, you can do. With struggling, you can do.
That's beautiful. We only have a little time left. I just want you to tell everybody about any events or any thing that's coming up that you'd like anybody to take part in.
Okay, I have a group in Brantford that called the Probus Group that have invited me to do some speaking in the 26th of May. I have my blog, which a hairdresser's diary, that if anybody's interested, I would love to have them come visit and talk to me through my blog. I have my website, ahairdressersdiary.com, and if anybody would like to check out my book, I have my book in Canada and United States through Amazon.com and .ca. I'm hoping to do an interview with CBC, Canadian Broadcasting. Yeah, we're working on that. And another interview with, it's called The Canadian Couch, and that's out of London, Ontario. So I have those things that we're working on coming up with, and again, I'm more than halfway through my sequel, so for this. And Sherry, what's funny is I have my customers and friends that are calling me and asking me if they could please be in the second book.
Oh, my God.
I think it
Everybody
is so cool.
Everybody wants a touch of it. You know, it's funny.
I think it's cool. Yeah. Chris, am I going to be in this one? Do you want to be in this one? Yes, please.
Oh, my God.
Well, because I wouldn't write anything mean or mean-spirited.
Of course, yeah.
So
that'd be,
if you're looking for a book
kind of cute.
Yeah, I think it's kind of cute, too. Yeah.
All right. I want to thank Christine and, like, my live audience to thank Christine for a wonderful interview. Next week, we will welcome Time's best-selling author Kevin J. Anderson about his novels Hell Hole Awakening and Unnatural Acts and all about his national book tour. Thank you, Christine. It was a really nice interview.
Thank you, Sherry. I so enjoyed myself.
Oh, good. Thank you for chatting with Sherry.